There's no question you need omega-3s. But which form should you take? Fish oil or krill oil? Scientists have debated this for years. Luckily, there's a new solution to satisfy everyone. It's called Krill Omega 50 Plus. It combines ultra-pure fish oil and joint-soothing krill oil together in just one tiny pill. It's so powerful, it can promote the health of your heart and your arteries. And if that wasn't enough, it can also boost your joint comfort in just days. We're so sure Krill Omega 50 Plus will work for you. We'll even send you a free bottle to put to the test. The debate is over. It's not fish oil or krill oil. It's both. And now it's free. Just pay $4.95 for shipping and claim your free bottle. Call now. 1-800-355-1493. 1-800-355-1493. That's 1-800-355-1493.
In working with Ken for all these years, I got used to sort of his way of doing things. One of the things that makes him comfortable and makes him worthwhile for your purposes is that he will take this information from all of the health journals that are published around the world and relate it to you so you understand what the information means to you. I have a very close friend in my hometown of Framingham who happens to be a state rep who's been fighting for about 2 years a really, really bad cancer.
Where is he being treated?
He's being treated at Brigham and it's Dana-Farber at Brigham and Women's in Boston.
Well, I'm sure they're giving him whatever
Everything that they have thrown everything, Ken. This is a bad case. And he was given, the first time around, he had a traditional chemo treatment, and it stabilized the cancer. It stopped it from growing while he was on it. Uh-huh. And then when he got off of it, it bounced right back again.
Have they tried immunotherapy with him?
Yes. He's done that. He's on that, as a matter of fact, now. But he went to, there was a process. They took his white blood cells and sent him to Seattle to have some kind of DNA
this
thing.
This is immunotherapy.
Yeah,
exactly.
Right. And it did the most of any treatment that he's had so far, but it didn't get rid of all of it.
So what they're trying to do is find a specific antigen to make an antibody.
And I saw him last week, and I thought he was done for. And yesterday, he and I had a conversation on the phone for an hour. I was thankful. I cried talking to him. He says, "Don't you get emotional, because then I'll get emotional." But he sounded so. I mean, he was telling me stuff that he wanted me to know that would take place if he weren't there.
So the immunotherapy is making him feel a little better?
Now he's on some other routine. They told him there's a 30-35% chance that it would work. All they're really trying to do is get him strong enough so he can do a bone marrow transplant, which for people, I went through that with my former wife. She had that 3 times, and it managed to keep her going for 21 years after she was basically at 44 given a death sentence because she had a really bad case, stage 4 breast cancer, and it was pretty much curtains.
Right. And looking at the new and the innovative, in the past you may have thought that, all they have to offer me is chemotherapy, horrible it is, and that's going to be, my final exit. Don't think that way anymore, because there's this whole new area of immunotherapy, which is different than chemotherapy.
Yes.
And that's why people are suddenly, when they had no hope before, making it out. One of our longest living presidents from Georgia.
His brain cancer. Look at him. He's in 90.
Exactly. He has had this new immunotherapy, and with the old chemotherapy, he would have never made it.
No.
And what they're doing with the immunotherapy, Doug, is they're just finding a unique protein on the cancer cell, which is not found on the normal cell. And then they just make an antibody against that unique protein. So they selectively kill the cancer cells, and all of the normal cells stay around. And
because this is such a new protocol, Ken, they were worried with him. He was under constant watch. Every 15 minutes, a nurse would come in. When he was on that protocol you're talking about that really wipes out the cancer. I mean, you could see in days the difference in his body.
And the problem with the chemotherapy is it could not so well select the normal from the cancer cells.
Right.
And it killed so many of the normal cells. Everything
killed
was
everything.
Gone.
Yeah, killed everything.
This is totally different.
This the impact on him in that it got rid of most of it, but it didn't get rid of all of it. So I don't know why they didn't do it again, except it really takes a toll on your body.
Unexpected, amazing effectiveness.
Yeah. Yeah, right. So I was so sad because he's a wonderful guy, And I thought he was done for. And yesterday, my God, it sounded like I was talking to a different person. My experience in my family with cancer has been a run. It's a one-way road, and it's the road out of town.
Well, that was so, before immunotherapy.
Yeah, right. It was. Yeah.
So if you have cancer in the family, you know, just make sure you're in a center where they have that as an option.
Yeah.
They may not go to it first, but just be where that is on the table.
And under the circumstances, my experience has been, I don't know what it is, wherever the teaching hospitals are, usually that's the best place to go for this kind of stuff. But in Boston, where everybody yaks about Mass General, I don't think Mass General is the best at anything. That's my experience, except when you sent me to the guy who is the brain expert. That was a fabulous experience for me, and he's at Mass General. But generally speaking, I can't say about heart stuff because I don't have anybody in my family. My father, you know, when he had his stroke, he wasn't really being treated. He was part of a protocol.
Well, you have a lot of choices where you are. You're fortunate.
Yeah, that's what I was going to point out. It was and Brigham and Women's and Dana-Farber now, really, when it comes to conventional care for this sort of thing, they're really on the cutting edge. And you can see it in the way they have several floors at Brigham and Women's. That's all they do. And everybody's in their own room. They're isolated. You wear a mask when you go in, you know, that kind of stuff. But I'm so happy that he's come back around and just, you know, hold a good thought for him. He's a fabulous guy. And so when you know the suffering, you can look at their faces and listen. I mean, a week ago he'd said to me, I've had enough of this. I don't want to do this anymore. And that's what Tony said at the end. You know, I just don't want to do this.
Was that before he started the immunotherapy or after?
Yeah, that was before. Then the weekend, they got him on this other thing.
Right.
They brought him home yesterday.
It's amazing.
So it really is. You know, it's something that you hold out for so many people. You know, the other side of it is, why is there so damn much cancer around? That's a different subject for a different, perhaps, discussion. But it is.
Well,
you know,
cancer generally is a disease of aging. And, you know, clearly there are environmental factors that do it, but it's also, you know, we're living longer. The start of our country.
Well, he's 65.
Uh-huh.
And Tony was only 44 when she got her. I think breast cancer is a different thing.
Well, there's a genetic component and there's smoking component.
Yeah, well,
there's other environmental issues. But, you know, you go back to the start of our country, 1776. You've heard me say this before. And the life expectancy was 35 years old.
George Washington was an old man at 45.
Ben Franklin was an oddity.
Yeah, very much so. He was in his 70s.
Odd. But 35 was the average life expectancy. Mm-hmm. So you're just going to see very little cancer. If people are going, it's 35.
Wasn't until after World War II that things started to change. The average man was lucky to live to be 50. Going through all this information that comes out every week from these various proceedings is very important because there's a lot of trending information here. So because Ken is a cardiologist, actually we started with this and then get off onto that. It was a good conversation about cancer treatments, that sort of thing. Let's talk about the research done and what's being published, the effects of eating meat that's well done, well cooked. This is for me. Well, I don't eat meat, but I won't eat fish that isn't well done. I won't touch sushi. I won't eat anything like this. I mean, I'll eat raw vegetables, things like that. But with meat, nope. I've seen too much of what happens and how the meat comes to the marketplace. So I wouldn't advise anybody to eat meat unless it's well done. But apparently that's not good for your blood pressure.
Well, I think in this study, they're seeing another option between raw and well done.
Yeah.
So this is a report from the American Heart Association meeting this week. And in fact, there's another report on meat from the Journal of Hepatology that we can get to. But first, the American Heart Association meeting study. And you might think twice about how you want the steak cooked, because people who like their steak well done instead of rare are 15% more likely to develop high blood pressure over the next 12 to 16 years. And reducing the amount of red meat and avoiding the use of open flame or high temperature cooking methods may potentially aid in high blood pressure prevention. And the key here is everything in moderation. I'm not advocating no red meat and never having something broiled, but just everything in moderation.
When's the last time you had a piece of red meat?
I'll probably have a steak once or twice a month.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. But mostly you eat fish.
Correct. And chicken and turkey and veal and
so do I take from what you just said
I'm on the Mediterranean diet.
Yeah,
but I'm not.
Know,
but, I'm not. I have treats. You know, I like to go to Ruth Chris. I'll give them a plug.
Really, you do.
Oh, absolutely.
You never took me there, but you know I don't.
Next time you're here, we'll go.
We'll go there. I'd rather have ice cream. If I'm going to have to be, if I'm going to be bad, I'd much rather have a bowl of ice cream.
I mean, I love occasionally having a grilled steak at Ruth Chris. I'm not. Treats are okay, but that's not what you want to live on every day.
No. So go back to the grilling thing for a minute. You talked about, I wasn't sure what you were saying. Grilling good, grilling bad? Because grilling brings this carcinogens galore.
Correct. Yeah, I was saying bad.
Yeah. Okay.
Avoiding the open flame or high temperature cooking.
That's
not good.
Really bad. Anything on the grill, I know it tastes great. It's one side
and
of it.
Again,
you know,
moderation.
It's wonderful. It's fun, but it's awful. Unless you cook it in aluminum foil or something.
Grilling, broiling, frying are not the best ways to go.
The open flame, really bad for you. This is Good Day Health. I'm Doug Steffen with Dr. Ken Kronhaus, who's having an interesting conversation with Kara, who's at the controls in our studio in Washington, about parenting. And now back to the focus on meats. If you're just joining us, Dr. Ken was talking about a survey, or a study actually done by American Heart Association, which suggests that if you cook your meat to a well-done state, it may not be good for your blood pressure. And so from that, we move into another focus on red meats, processed meats, and what else that's harmful for. So let's get to that, Ken.
Yeah, interesting. In the same week, there's a report also about red and processed meats, and it's linked to the liver. And this is in the Journal of Hepatology. Hepatology is just a big word in medicine for liver, study of liver. So eating a lot of processed and red meats increases your risk of developing a serious liver condition and insulin resistance also, which is a precursor to type 2 diabetes, Doug. People who consume the highest amounts of red and processed meats, they have a nearly 50% increased risk of, this is a mouthful, non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, and more than 50% higher risk of developing insulin resistance. Also, cooking meat at high temperature, as we talked about before, for a long time, such as grilling, broiling, or frying, it's associated with about a double the risk of insulin resistance. And this is the pathway to diabetes again. So non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, what is that? This is a condition that causes fat to deposit in the liver. And in some people, this can lead to inflammation and scarring of the liver. So this can be a serious problem.
We had cows that would get fatty liver disease.
Exactly.
They die from it.
Exactly.
Treat it well. Liver, I think people forget. I think the liver and perhaps the kidneys are taken for granted. Most people don't know what they do, how they function, how important they are to your health and well-being. Do you agree with that statement?
Oh, critical. Most people, they happen passively. You know, I think we think about our kidneys a bit. It's hard it's hard to forget about your kidneys. But the liver, boy, that's working there. We have no idea it's working. It's not working till it's not working.
Right, and you better take care of it. We have a lot of good supplements around, things that you can eat
that
are good.
Watch the alcohol, the acetaminophen. These are all workouts for the liver.
Yeah,
and get down to ideal body weight because the fat gets deposited in the liver.
Yeah, very important. Pay attention to it. Take supplements. That's what I do.
It's the filter of the body. You can't live without it.
No, it is. Everything that goes through your body out is going through. That's a great way of describing it, Ken, the filter of the body. So pay attention to your liver and don't eat processed food. That's pretty much the message there.
And it also makes a lot of important ingredients that you need for your body to function properly.
Yep.
Balance of Nature's fruits and veggies.
I was surprised at myself how much energy I had. And, you know, I'm doing two jobs, running around like a maniac, and I was able to handle it. Really, I'm like, wow. This stuff is really good. So, you know, more than anything else, it's it just gave me the extra energy and the well-being, feeling of well-being that I don't think I would have without it.
Well, I take it every day, and I feel great. And my wife looks at me and says, how come you never get sick? And I do. It's because I take the fruits and veggies.
I just feel a lot better. My life has turned around. Everything is working for me.
It just helps me feel good. I just think the products are wonderful, and I take them every day. I just like it. It works.
When you call, use discount code DJV, and we'll take 35% off your first month's order and ship it to you free. Call 800-246-8751 or go online to balanceofnature.com and use discount code DJV.
Okay, next item of interest here from the various studies that Ken has examined this week is a focus on housework and why it's this is, I don't know, this is medical or psychological sometimes. Well, I believe, you know me, I talk about spirit, mind, body connection all the time. And so the psychological impact of a husband picking up the housework and what it does to the romance, I don't know what this is. Medically speaking, are you just flirting with this because you thought it was an interesting story?
Well, we've all seen Chicago, you know, when mom is happy, everyone's happy, if I can paraphrase. And this, I think, is an offshoot of that. This comes out of a very legitimate medical journal called Social Forces this month. Husbands who are less than satisfied with their sex lives might want to fire up the vacuum cleaner, Doug. And why? Because this new research suggests that when partners in a marriage feel the division of housework is fair, sexual satisfaction improves for both. And like in most marriages, communication is so important. This is something, guys, you want to talk to your wife about, and vice versa.
All right. So I'm going to carry this one step further in terms of romance, romantic partners, and what they do or they don't do with each other. There's a study out this week that I'm sure you avoided, or you probably didn't see it, but if you did see it, you would have avoided it because it's indelicate.
Yes,
but it has to do
this.
With passing gas. Yeah, did you see it?
Go. You take this.
Oh, yeah. You're going to let me carry the water here. The idea of breaking wind in front of or with your romantic partner, it happens in bed. I mean, come on. We've all, it happens in the car.
We all do this.
Of course
we
do.
Men and women. Believe it or not, women also.
Yes.
We all have to.
Women don't want to admit it, but they do. I've been told by someone better than me, I think, in many ways that, we don't pass gas. It's not, you know, it's like asking a woman how old she is. When's the last time you passed gas? Anyway.
Yeah, exactly. This is not a good question.
The bottom line is, if you pass gas, toot, if you will, with your partner, it's looked upon as being a good thing. It means the two people are in love and at ease with each other. Then there are couples who are not comfortable even about talking about the idea of passing gas, never mind actually doing it. They find it humiliating. And if that's the case, if you can't, this study suggests, this is done by a woman named Shannon Chavez, psychologist, sex therapist, works with couples, says that if you can't talk about normal body functions, if you can't have fun around passing gas, if you think it's gross, dirty, stinky, and not to be discussed, then your marriage is over. Your romance is dead. That's the way
it's a good sign that you're attached and comfortable and at one with each other if you can get to this level.
So last night, Megan and Miles and I were in a restaurant.
And this
woman,
this theory.
It wasn't just that. There's a kid who walked by the table, and he let out this huge fart. I looked at his mother,
good,
and we burst into laughter, into gales of laughter, and he started talking about his gas.
And as a problem.
Well, he was a little late. I think he was about a year older than Miles. So Miles doesn't really, you know, he's just getting out of diapers and stuff, so it's not.
Did
poop
Miles
was a healthy
laugh?
Conversation. Miles didn't hear the conversation. Megan did.
Miles is the grandson for everybody.
Yeah, Miles is my grandson. My daughter is Megan. And so we all just had a big laugh about it. But yet it's something that's so normal, it's like your heart beating. It's something that your body has to do because there are impurities in your body that just there, like you get rid of through urination or you go to the bathroom.
Unfortunately, there are cultures that consider this dirty and something you never talk about. And I'm not advocating that, but I have.
No, because it's a good sign your body is working well. But you got to get rid of the urine, you got to get rid of the solids, and you got to get rid of the gas. And sometimes it doesn't all work that way at the same time. Sometimes it does, and sometimes it doesn't.
I would not recommend that you try out this theory with people you don't know well.
No, you can't. You can't do it unless you're very comfortable with them.
With the
person. And even then, I can remember having an experience that was absolutely hysterical. We were riding to Florida, and I was asked to stop because she needed to go to the bathroom. It was obvious she needed it. When I teased her about it, she got her face got all red, and she started laughing. No, it's not me! You know, that kind of stuff.
Right. Well, the point is, if you're laughing at others for this, someone else is going to get the last laugh. I guarantee you, before you get off of planet Earth.
Right. But if you don't have flatulence, you got a larger health
problem.
You're
obstructed.
Yes, exactly. You know, it's controlling it more than anything else.
Well, it's a lot has to do with what you eat. You know, if you're on an incredibly high whole grain diet, fiber, you know, you're going to be making a lot of noise.
Gas. Yep, a lot of burping. The girls laugh at me because of how much, you know, when we're not on the air and the
mic's on. You're on a high fiber diet.
I'm happy to.
So you're tooting away.
Plenty of stuff coming out of both.
You don't
ends.
Want any explosion in there.
Probably too much information. All right, let's keep moving here. Hold
it's
on.
It's like that old, that old steam pot that you had with the little safety valve that would
toot
keep it from exploding.
Yes. Dr. Kent Kronhaus, Dr. Doug Steffen on Good Day Health. The way to avoid catching the flu on the plane. Here we go. Ken, this is something that's been floating around this week. A lot of people have been talking about this. What's the secret?
It's going to be harder to get those window seats after you hear this.
Right.
And this is a serious study done out of the very reputable Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. This is not junk science. And these scientists studied where is the best place to sit in an airplane when people have flu and are coughing away. And they concluded after studying air currents and people movements that if you're worried about catching a cold or flu on an airplane, Doug, get a window seat and do not leave it until the flight is over. That's your best chance.
You know, that is, if you're on a 6-7 hour flight, it's hard to do
then
that.
Then you have an issue, yes. You don't want to get, you're trading off blood clots for the flu.
I do not sit on the window seat, especially when I go back and forth across the country every week or so. I will sit on an aisle and that's it. If I'm in a row, if I have to sit in like the bulkhead or someplace like that, it's kind of cozy actually to be on the inside seat because you can put your head against the side of the plane, go to sleep.
Well, but you've done well over the years. You haven't gotten it. So it's not broken, don't fix it. But this is what, what they concluded.
When you think about the stuff that's in the plane, we talk about Salmonella, E. coli, and other bacteria, Listeria, all these things that are around food that is cooked. But they've done studies of planes because they don't clean the planes anymore like they used to. They never wipe off the trays. They don't wipe. The bathroom is, you're lucky to have that clean. Walk into a bathroom on a plane, the floor is always sticky. Even when you, it is.
I would agree with that.
Awful. What is being suggested by some is that there's a new LED light, have you heard about this, that has wavelengths that kill bacteria?
And
they're trying to use those on planes to kill 23 different kinds of germs. They're called Illumini light. I think it's ELLUMI, Illumi lights. And you put them in areas of question, and they will bump off all of the bad bugs that are in, whether it's your kitchen, your bathroom, the plane, wherever it is. Dr. Ken Kronhaus continues with his service here by overviewing some more of the information that comes out from the various studies that are done, reported on by the medical journals. For example, the risk of dying during pregnancy has doubled if the body that's carrying the host, that would be the mother, is anemic. So why would you, if you're under doctor's care, maybe that's the issue here, Ken.
Exactly.
If you're under doctor's care, how would you get to be anemic?
Well, this is a warning. If you're going to get pregnant, please get to the doctor beforehand and check with a simple blood test. This comes out of the medical journal Lancet Global Health. Anemic pregnant women are twice as likely to die during or shortly after pregnancy than those who are without the blood condition. This is simply diagnosed with a blood test and can be treated almost always. So just take good care of yourself because you got to be around for that child.
All right. So then there's the additional information that comes out this week with regard to a pregnant woman or what happens before you become pregnant. And this looks like a very interesting, the size of one's waist. So what do we glean from this, Ken?
Yeah, this week in the Endocrine Society, we learned that the pre-pregnancy width of a woman's waist, but not whether or not she is actually obese, may be tied to autism risk in her children. And I had a feeling you'd ask me, how is this possible? Well, let me give you the theory.
Let me ask the question. Wait a minute. Ken, how is this possible?
Well, this link, Doug, may be due to fat-induced activity of inflammatory chemicals. They're known as cytokines, which are known to be involved in the development of autism. And it seems that children born to women with a waist circumference of 31.5 inches or more before pregnancy, they're 65% more likely to have autism than those born to mothers with smaller pre-pregnancy waist. So the magic number is 31.5. So mom, if you want to get pregnant, maybe you want to get to the gym beforehand if that waist is more than 31.5.
So keep your waist at 31.5 or below.
Before you get pregnant.
Before you get pregnant, it's not going to stay there, obviously, when you're pregnant. But in general, isn't that a rule? In terms of long life, you know, there's 36
above
for men or something. I've forgotten. You have a table that you've referenced 40, from time to time.
It's usually 40, under 40 for men and under 32 for women is what we usually quote. This study went down to 31.5.
Well, but are we talking about general longevity, or are we talking about, you know, with somebody who's got a waist that's under, like yours is probably, mine's 34. What, yours is probably 33, 32.
Yes,
what's your
good
waist?
Yeah. Exactly. Very
okay.
Good.
All right. So
you have a great eye.
We're in better shape than most, and I even feel uncomfortable with mine being, I think it spreads out a little depending on the time of year, to 35 or 36. But you get to 40, and you see some of these people walking around. You know, the best place to see how bad it is to walk around the airport like I do and see the people. I mean, any place that people congregate, though. And what I find more troubling is when you sit in a seat next to somebody.
Oh, wow.
Who's, like, it's just really
and waist,
awful.
Waist circumference, Doug, it's an indicator of what's known as central obesity. This is abdominal fat stored around important organs such as liver, mm-hmm. pancreas, and intestines. And that's why the BMI is not really a good predictor of this.
Well, fatty liver is a problem that's caused, and it's something I just learned about recently. Actually, I learned about it because the cows get it. And it's, as you suggested, cows sometimes get pretty hefty depending on what they're eating. And if the fat sticks around the liver, it's really, it can cause malfunction there.
Absolutely.
It's a real problem.